the QR code here on KPFK every Monday through Thursday at 6 a.m. And if you're not an early riser like Kevin, you can catch the rebroadcast every Monday through Thursday at 4 p.m.
Be sure to join us next time as we share our news with our voice from our perspective. And until then,
peace.
Many listeners make KPFK possible by giving what they can. Some donate monthly, others give once a year, and some give in a big way by donating land or real estate that they no longer need. That unused cabin, a vacant lot, or a home that's no longer in use, those properties can help ensure a future for your community radio station. Real estate donations can come with tax benefits for you and lasting value for KPFK. It's easy to start. Just visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
Support comes from CAP UCLA presenting Seth Parker Woods, Julia Bullock, and Connor Hanick on January 15th at the Nimoy. The powerhouse musicians unite for an evening that showcases Titan composers of lyricism and storytelling from the 20th and 21st centuries. Together, the musicians perform the works of George Walker, Nina Simone, and more. More information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFA 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the surfing, California and beyond.
This is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. My wonderful co-host Jim Lafferty is taking the day off today, but he'll be back with us next week. And in the meantime, we've got a great show lined up for you today. First, we'll be joined by constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde, and he'll be walking us through the many legal and ethical issues surrounding U.S. attacks on Venezuela. And we'll also cover some other developing legal news stories as well. Then stay with us, please, because we'll be joined by attorney Michael Rapkin about the renewed calls to close Guantanamo Bay Prison, which is still operating and holding prisoners after 24 years. And it's now even being used to hold deported immigrants who were formerly living on U.S. soil. So please do stay tuned for that. But since the clock is ticking, let's get right into it. Our guest this segment is Stephen Rohde, our resident expert on issues involving the Trump administration's attacks on the rule of law. Steve is a political activist, writer, and lecturer. He practiced law for more than 50 years in the areas of civil rights and liberties and intellectual property. He's a former chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, chair emeritus of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice, a founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and he serves as the special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He's authored numerous books, a couple of books, at least three, right? Right, Steve? He's nodding and thumbs up, and scores of articles, which have appeared in the LA Times, Ms. Magazine, and the Los Angeles Review of Books, among other publications. Steve hosts a podcast produced by Ms. Studios called Speaking Freely, Exploring the First Amendment, and he also co-hosts Law and Disorder. That's a radio show and podcast, along with Jim Lafferty and myself. So Steve Rohde, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria. Happy New Year. Let's hope there's more justice and democracy this year than last.
I hope so. Well, I want to start off with one of the biggest news stories of the week, the U.S. military's attack in Venezuela and capture of its president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores. Can you talk us through the legal authority, first of all, which the Trump administration claims it's using to justify these actions? And how are critics responding?
Yes, let me do that in the overall context of the lawlessness of the Trump administration. And I really don't want to go another moment without recognizing Renee Nicole Good, a 37-year-old American citizen, shot three times in the face and killed earlier today by an ICE agent in an unjustified murder. The only remedy is to fire that individual and try him criminally for that case. But it simply is an example of a lawless administration that has no restraints within the United States and no restraints outside the United States. So in the last hours of 2025, a broad military operation swept into Venezuela, bombing Caracas, killing 80 people on the pretext of arresting Maduro, his wife, and charging them under a 2020 indictment that had been issued in the Southern District of New York, along with 14 other defendants. It is a lawless operation, both under international law and under domestic law, where it violates the Constitution. Internationally, the UN Charter prohibits any use of force against another nation, except in an imminent act of self-defense. There is literally no evidence of any act of self-defense that justified this overwhelming use of military invasion. Now on the domestic side, given this use of force, the Trump administration violated the War Powers Resolution of 1973, which gave Congress primacy in the issue of using force, even in a defensive role. So it remains to be seen, and I think we have some follow-up questions on this topic.
Yes, for sure. Let's talk about the criminal case against Maduro and his wife. What charges are they facing, and can you talk us through some of the backstory that led to this moment?
Well, there was a 2020 indictment in the Southern District of New York. It alleges, and it's been since modified and superseded by additional allegations, it alleges charges of narco-terrorism, cocaine trafficking conspiracy, weapons possession, and a variety of different federal charges within those categories. As I said, there are approximately 15 defendants. One can only wonder if we're going to invade Venezuela to arrest the other 14 of them. It is a criminal charge, but no steps were taken to extradite Maduro and his wife. God forbid the lawful procedures across the world that are used to extradite defendants was not even considered by the administration or pursued. Unfortunately, American law currently holds that how a defendant is brought into court is not cognizable, in this case, by the federal court sitting in the Southern District. So it is left to international tribunals and public opinion to judge the Trump administration's tactics in bringing Maduro into the New York court.
Well, I understand Maduro and his wife retained a very respected lawyer to lead their defense. Can you tell us who he is? I think it's somebody you're familiar with. And also talk about some of the possible legal defenses.
Well, there's no bad guy exception to due process or international law or federal law. So now Maduro and his wife are in U.S. custody. and they have engaged Barry Pollack. I was pleased in the sense of the right to counsel to see Barry Pollack in this case. Maria and Jim and I and others know him for representing Julian Assange and very skillfully leading to the release of Julian Assange and his return home to his family in Australia. So Barry Pollack is a capable lawyer, and he will give the Maduros an effective defense. One of the key defenses is presidential immunity. American law recognizes immunity for the heads of state, but there will be a conflict over whether Maduro is the lawfully legitimate head of state, given the questions surrounding his most recent election. And the Noriega case will figure prominently, if we all remember Noriega being captured, returned to Florida, tried, and convicted as well. That case, the Maduro case, is pending, and we're going to have to see how that case now plays out.
Well, whether or not Maduro and his wife are, or either or, are convicted of any crimes, what are some of the broader implications for how this arrest came about, and what's the precedent being set here?
Well, we have some of the precedent in the Noriega case, and that conviction was upheld. I hinted at this a few minutes ago. This and many other areas we are more and more learning is simply the brute use of force. Donald Trump crowed and was brazen about the arrest. Trump said there are iron laws that have always determined global power. Well, we're seeing that on full display from Trump, from Stephen Miller and others. They are exercising iron laws, and it's going to be the responsibility of Congress on the domestic side to rail him in. It's going to be the role of international courts and the UN. There have been some announcements and condemnations of U.S. conduct, but it really has to go beyond that. And overall, and as you know, my own theme, the law goes only so far. It's a case of U.S. Protest resistance, as well as the election this year in the midterms and in 2028 in the next presidential election.
Well, thanks for that, Steve. I'd like to switch topics now and talk about the National Guard troops that have been deployed and may continue to be deployed in certain U.S. cities. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court stopped Trump from keeping troops in Chicago, and then Trump kind of surprised us all by announcing he was withdrawing troops from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland. But I understand there will be other places where they'll continue on. Can you talk about the Supreme Court's ruling and also Trump's decision?
Yes, shortly before Christmas Eve, the U.S. Supreme Court gave the Constitution a gift. It was rare in a what now appears to be, and I'll explain why I say it that way, a 6-3 ruling. On December 23rd, the Supreme Court refused to allow Donald Trump to deploy hundreds of National Guard troops in Chicago. In a very short three-page unsigned ruling, it found that the president had not met the standards for using force and the National Guard in a domestic situation. That is prohibited by the Posse Comitatus Law of 1878. This was a rare victory for the interest of justice. As we've discussed on this show repeatedly, in its shadow docket, the Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld what Trump is doing, even before those cases have reached the merits. J.B. Pritzker, governor of Illinois, called this a victory for democracy, an important step in curbing the Trump administration's consistent abuse of power and slowing his march toward authoritarianism. From a legal standpoint, we could have predicted that three of the dissenting justices would have granted cert in that case and reviewed the lower court injunction against Trump. Those dissents came from Justice Samuel Alito and Justice Clarence Thomas. In a ridiculous comment, and I have to call it that, by Justice Neil Gorsuch, here's a man who has approved shadow docket stays repeatedly. And in this case, he said this presented weighty questions which deserved a full airing and should not be decided on an emergency basis. After that very justice and his Republican conservative colleagues have joined in the dismantling of the Department of Education, the hiring of federal employees, and all the rest. Well, they got some of their own medicine here, where the rest of the court, at least five, if not six, was willing to slap back at Trump. And as you said, perhaps reading the tea leaves, Trump immediately withdrew National Guard troops from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland, Oregon. He crowed about coming back perhaps some other day. But for now, it is a day that the rule of law has prevailed. These troops are being removed. Sadly, they are being replaced by ICE agents, as we talked about at the top of the show, that are continuing to do some of the very same mischief.
Yes, Stephen, I did want to thank you for that, for giving the memorial. At least we don't know that much yet, but for 37-year-old U.S. citizen Renee Nicole Good, who was shot and killed by an ICE agent in Minneapolis, and which just gives what you're saying, talks about, you know, it gives us a sense of the danger of militarizing our cities. And can you just let us know the status of the National Guard deployments elsewhere? What can we expect next?
Well, they are being systematically removed from the cities I mentioned. But Trump didn't promise to stay his hand otherwise. So the court has spoken, at least on this temporary interim basis. That case will be heard on the merits later this year. It may be an example that Trump has decided to move on. He's gotten his, sadly, pound of flesh. And what I regret in the case of the woman who was just killed is that the ICE agents have now become the brown shirts of Munich and Berlin and Germany. These are the wide-ranging attack troops that Hitler used in advancing the Nazi regime. This is a band of lawless, armed renegades that see no limit in law from what they can do. And now, as we warned, beyond immigrants, it is being visited upon American citizens.
Hmm. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall, and I'm here talking right now to Stephen Rohde, our resident expert on constitutional issues and all things affecting our rule of law. And Steve, before we run out of time, there were a couple of cases I wanted to ask you about. One is last week, a federal judge ruled that a law regulating what was called, you know, anti-Semitism in kindergarten through 12th grade classrooms can stand, but it's a little confusing. The law is called AB 715. Can you tell us what this law does and why it's so controversial?
Yes, AB 715 did pass late last year and was signed by Governor Newsom over the objections of the ACLU, of other organizations that I'm associated with. What it does is it creates an anti-Semitism a coordinator in the public school system. It indicates that teachers can be punished for what is called discrimination by anti-Semitism. Unfortunately, the California new law, which now has gone into effect on January 1st, incorporates and adopts the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition and examples of anti-Semitism. This is a very controversial policy. It was never intended to become law. And many of its examples conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. The aspects of the law that want to combat genuine anti-Semitism can be applauded. The problem is that once again in California now, they've blurred that line. And a group of students and teachers went to court. They brought a lawsuit against AB 715. Only on a preliminary basis did the federal judge deny a preliminary injunction. But the judge said that it was preliminary, that the facts have to play out in how this law is going to be enforced through the state of California and school boards around the state. The court indicated that prominent observers had criticized the definition of anti-Semitism that's being used. I think this case is alive and kicking. There were some celebrations by supporters of AB 715 that it's a dead letter, but it's hardly that. And as we see how this law is played out, we are watching, the court is watching. Combating anti-Semitism should not include the punishment of classroom discussion on history, the Middle East, and what Israel is doing in Gaza.
And can you also clarify, you did say it was conflating anti-Semitism with criticism of Israel. Can you just briefly expand on what you mean by that?
Yes. Well, there were examples in the definition of accusing Israel of genocide or comparing Israel to the Nazis. Now, we can disagree with some of those characterizations, but that's Israel is a country. It's the state of Israel. It is not insulated from criticism for what it's doing in Gaza and elsewhere, any more than the United States or Russia, China, or any other country can be criticized. That's what's protected by the First Amendment. And to go down the road and allow teachers to be disciplined in the name of combating anti-Semitism when what they are doing is discussing and criticizing Israel is extremely dangerous. So I think we're going to have to monitor that law and be very strict about protecting academic freedom and the First Amendment.
Well, speaking of freedom in the schools and the First Amendment, there's a case about book banning that caught my interest. In Texas, a court recently ruled that a city's officials could remove books from their public library that deal with themes of race and LGBTQ identity. Now, I understand the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to hear it. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, this is a very depressing case for me, having tracked these book bannings for decades. In a silent ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal by a group of residents of a rural Texas county of an earlier opinion that local officials could remove 17 books from a public library, which they considered objectionable for dealing with themes of race and LGBTQ identity. There were Supreme Court precedents that would have banned such book banning, if you will. And so for the U.S. Supreme Court not even to take this case is deeply troubling. The 17 works included a 1970 book, In the Night Kitchen, by acclaimed author Maurice Sendak due to the depiction of its main character, a boy named Mickey, who's nude in an illustration as he visits a surreal kitchen in a dream. There are other books on those other themes that I mentioned. Well, this rural county of Llano County, Texas, banned those and several other books that dealt with transgender issues, race, slavery in the United States, puberty, bodily functions, etc. One of the judges then, it went up to the Ninth Circuit, I'm sorry, the Fifth Circuit, covering Texas, and in a 10-7 decision, relatively close for the entire court, meaning seven of the judges would have denied the book banning. And one of the judges, a Trump appointee, said that no one is banning books. They're just removed from the library. Anyone can order them online or at a bookstore or borrow from a friend. This is outlandish First Amendment law. You don't offer an act of censorship any solace because what's been censored is available elsewhere. But having said that, the fact that the current Supreme Court in the grip of this six-member conservative majority would not even grant cert to have this fully briefed is a deep disappointment. So we cannot have celebrate the Supreme Court in all of its respects. When it does something good, then it turns around and does something bad.
Well, as you said, that may be a depressing one, so we want to leave you with some good news. Or please leave us with some good news. How about, you know, a federal court just ordered the Trump administration to restore the student record for Rumeysa Oetskirk? Why was her record taken away, and what does it mean to her to have it restored?
Your listeners will remember that months ago we discussed the case of Ms. Oetskirk, a graduate student at Tufts University, grabbed off the street. And it's again the ICE agents in a lawless act of kidnapping, grabbed this innocent young woman off the street. She was held for 45 days of detention in the shameful for-profit ICE prison in Louisiana. And what pretext did the government give? She wrote an op-ed in the school newspaper demanding that the university consider student demands about the war in Gaza. Instead, Trump had her arrested and detained. Her habeas corpus, she is now free and at freedom in the United States. Her habeas corpus case challenging her arrest and detention is pending in a federal district court in Vermont, and portions of it are being reviewed by the Second Circuit. But she had been stripped of her SEVIS, which is the database maintained by ICE to track foreign students, including F1 student status by, like Ms. Oetskirk. Now, because this has been restored to her by a federal court, she is allowed to participate in employment and research experiences and activities that are integral to her graduate studies while her case is pending. That's a very important act of restoring her to those privileges and rights which she never should have been denied. She issued a very touching statement that here in the U.S., it is truly sad how much valuable knowledge is currently being lost due to the widespread fear of punishment within the academic community. So Ms. Oetskirk has received a measure of justice this week. We hope her habeas is fully granted and she returns to her full status. It is a glimmer of hope in a time of deep despair as Trump continues to attack students and our educational institutions more broadly.
Well, Stephen Rohde, we are out of time for this segment, but before we go, please let listeners know how they can read more of your works and listen to you on your podcast.
Well, I'm very proud that much of my work is published by LA Progressive, as well as Truth Dig and other publications. I discovered all my works are available online. I'm very proud to be with you and the others on Law and Disorder, broadcast on 200 stations across the country, on released on Mondays. And I'm equally proud of Speaking Freely, a First Amendment podcast, which traces the 10 most important cases in the area of free speech issued by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, thank you. As always, we so much appreciate you doing so much homework for us and encapsulating everything so clearly for us. So, Stephen Rohde, thanks again for joining us on the Lawyers Guild Show.
It's my pleasure, and I do hope people stay tuned for my good friend Michael Rabkin to talk about Close Guantanamo.
Yes, I was going to say that as well. We're going to have a very brief station ID break, and then we are going to be back to talk about a very important topic, Guantanamo Bay, which we kept thinking was going to close, and it's bigger than ever. So stay tuned for that.
It's one thing to love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.
What's going on, family? From the Bay to L.A., my name is Kat Brooks. My show, Law and Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters. The weekly state terror roundup, resistance in residence with artists using their gifts to change the world, and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and build. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 8 a.m. on 90.7 or at kpfk.org.
This is Chris Hedges, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, heard globally at kpfk.org.
All right, we are back. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. Again, I'm Maria Hall, and my co-host Jim Lafferty is taking the day off today, but he'll be back next week. So now we will return to the subject of Guantanamo Bay, the American military prison in Cuba that opened just a few months after September 11th, 2001. In all, 780 prisoners are known to have been held there post-9/11 under inhumane and tortuous conditions and in violation of international law. 24 years later, some of those original prisoners remain. And today, Guantanamo is also being used to hold immigrants. Trump had announced on January 29th that the base was being prepared to hold up to 30,000 immigrants. Whether or not that number is feasible, the U.S. did start sending detained immigrants there beginning February 5th of 2025. But the public is not standing idly by. Our next guest will tell us about some of the events planned this weekend to protest against the ongoing use of Guantanamo Bay Prison, or Gitmo, as it's also known, and to demand the release of everyone currently being held there. Our guest is Michael Rapkin, a senior partner at the law firm Rapkin and Associates. Michael was a member of the Guantanamo Bar between 2005 and 2018, and he represented two clients there, and traveled to meet with them three times at the prison. Both of his clients were transferred out via habeas corpus litigation after undergoing torture and indefinite detention at the hands of the U.S. government. Michael also serves as an advocate for the homeless and is a civil rights lawyer. Michael Rapkin, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite and the opportunity to discuss with your listeners what's going on in Guantanamo Bay.
Yes. And since it may have been a little while since people thought about Guantanamo, in broad strokes, can you remind us why was Guantanamo Bay detention camp first opened and why? And why it's been so controversial?
Certainly. First of all, in American history, it is unprecedented to have a prison like Guantanamo Bay. Why is that? Since the beginning of American jurisprudence, the United States has had its federal and state court system and the prisons within the United States. After 9/11, the George W. Bush administration wanted to avoid using American law and due process. And so what it began doing as of January 11, 2002, 24 years ago, is to fly in alleged Al-Qaeda fighters directly to Guantanamo Bay, where Bush and his administration thought that the government and the military could act outside the law, outside of U.S. soil, they can do so. And what did that mean? It meant that for years, the prisoners there did not have a right to seek habeas corpus protection. They did not have access to a lawyer. They were being indefinitely detained without trial, as you earlier stated. And they were quite tortured. That would not have happened, I believe, on American soil. So this legal black hole we call Guantanamo is a historical anomaly in both American military and legal practice.
Well, you represented two prisoners at Guantanamo. What were they and the other inmates accused of? And what obstacles did you face in representing them? I can't even imagine having to travel that far, but what else did you experience?
Well, first of all, getting to Guantanamo and being able to represent them was the easy part. In 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court determined and ruled that the prisoners in Guantanamo, A, had a right to counsel, and B, with another case that they had a right to habeas corpus protection. So volunteer lawyers were requested to come from around the country to represent these detainees. I quickly volunteered, spent a couple of days in D.C. learning more about habeas corpus and the torture there. And before I knew it, the next month, I filed my first habeas corpus petition in 2005. The question is, for my two clients and the others, what are they accused of and what did they allegedly do? They're accused of being Al-Qaeda members. They're accused of being supporters of Osama bin Laden, who planned allegedly the 9/11 attacks. And these same people are accused of fighting against the United States after 9/11. We faced obstacles. Think about a California lawyer like myself having clients in Cuba, in a foreign country. And so what I and all the other lawyers stationed in the United States had to do, and there's some in UK as well, is we had difficulty meeting with and speaking to our clients who were imprisoned in Cuba. They had hearsay issues that we had to overcome in our legal briefing. We did not have access to confidential, or I should say classified, materials and being able to share the so-called evidence with our clients. A further obstacle, I should say, is that being there, our choices were to either eat McDonald's or Subway. There's very little on the at the base. But that was it. And then dealing with the torture, incredible. So I know a lot that I cannot even discuss because to this day it's deemed to be classified. But there has been a lot of published information that I can share.
Wow. Well, in general, how long did the Guantanamo Bay prisoners wait behind bars before receiving anything even resembling a trial? And what were some of those conditions that you might be able to talk about?
Certainly. I believe that there were no trials ever to this day. And I will make an exception with the military commission systems, which I will briefly speak about shortly. But they have not had trials. They did not even have a right to an attorney, as I said, until at least 2005, which is when I first filed the habeas petition, as well as others. Some of them, including my second client, Mohammed Ghanem, arrived on Guantanamo soil January 11, 2002. He was one of the first 20 prisoners to arrive. And many of them, are still there 24 years later. And most of them have been released because there was never any charges against them. They had no trial. They had no due process. They were simply tortured. So hundreds were released during the George W. Bush administration, over 500. When Obama was president, he, like President Biden, attempted to close Guantanamo, but failed due to the failure primarily of Congress. So there were prisoners during Obama's time. Almost 200 were eventually transferred out. And the same with President Biden in his last days. I think he let out either 11 or 13 members, leaving only 15 of them today. 15 are still there.
And have the conditions improved, do you know? Are they different than what your clients experienced, for example?
Yes, they have improved. I can discuss, if you'd like, the three different types of terrible torture that the prisoners endured. But I've yet to read, in the last few years, that existing prisoners are enduring the torture, unless you consider indefinite detention without trial torture. There really were three types of torture, Maria. There was the physical torture, and my first client would be met almost daily with three, four, or five fully clothed people in armor, beat them up and took them out of the prison cell in order to take them to interrogation or for other reasons. In addition to that, there was what we call sensory and environmental manipulation, i.e. sleep deprivation. My second client, Mohammed Ghanem, was in what's called the frequent flyer program. And for six months, every 2 hours or whenever the guards overlooking him saw him sleeping, they would wake him up and put him into another cell to prevent him from sleeping. There's also the psychological and religious humiliation, which might still be existing today. And that's where the military have desecrated and defaced and even flushed the Quran down the toilets. My client, Yosef Al-Rabayesh, was once praying, which is allowed under federal law, and was kicked in the eye and was bleeding from the eye simply because he was on his knees and praying as a Muslim would do. And last but not least is the forced feeding. Clients, many, many were on hunger strikes, and Mohammed Ghanem was one of them. And if you can picture this, it's just disgusting to even think about. But they were force-fed, hands tied to a chair, and a rubber tubing was placed inside their nose and down into their stomach area, in which I think it was Ensure, a liquid protein, was forced into their body. And this went on basically twice a day for quite a while, simply because they said, we don't want to live under these conditions. So we're going to strike.
Wow. Well, you mentioned there were still some original prisoners there. Do you know how many? And then I do want to switch to the immigration issues.
Sure.
Are there still very many original prisoners there, or do you have a sense of the status?
I have a good sense of the status. And currently there are 15 prisoners left at Guantanamo Bay. And the question is, well, first of all, of the 15 that are still there, two have been convicted, which means that we can imprison them anywhere, including anywhere within federal prisons in the United States, including but not limited to federal maximum prisons. There's no reason to hold them there. Three of them have been held without charge ever and have been recommended for release. They have not been, so that is a illegal to happen. It is an indefinite law of war detention violation, and they can either be charged or let them go. Three more have been cleared for transfer. We have what's called the Periodic Review Board, which is part of the administration, and they have actually approved these people to be released, but these people are still awaiting for a host country or the culpable country, the United States, our country, could simply let them in and give them a way of life. And left is seven that are charged with trials pending. This includes the high-value detainees, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged 9/11 mastermind. Four of these seven cases will never be resolved through a contested trial because the CIA tortured them, and that evidence is not going to come in. A fifth has already been ruled incompetent to stand trial due to the harm he sustained from his torture. The military commission system is overlooking these cases, and the military commission system is a joke. It was set up to be outside of U.S. law so that they don't have the right to speedy trial, there's indefinite detention. They can use hearsay evidence to help convict them. And there's so many problems with it that both the prosecutors are appealing decisions made by the, I think there's now six military judges that keep changing the judges, which delays everything. And the defense counsel have appeals about certain rulings which have been made. I predict there'll never be a military commission trial. And the people have already been held since the Military Commissions Act of 2006. We're in pretrial hearings for 16 years or so.
Wow, that's definitely worse than the state courts here. I won't complain. I wanted to, and if listeners are just tuning in, I'm Maria Hall. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm speaking with Michael Rapkin about Guantanamo Bay Prison. So, Michael, when Trump began his second term last January, 2025, he claimed the U.S. government intended to imprison up to 30,000 immigrants at Guantanamo. Can you give us a sense of how many have been held there? And I mean, immigrants who have been detained by the U.S. government, and whether they've been accused of committing any crimes, and if so, whether they expect a trial before being deported. What's the status of this other track now of people who they want to detain?
Sure. Thank you for the question. First and foremost, as you said, Trump, I hate to use the word president before the name because he's not deserving of that, but President Trump did say he wanted to put up to 30,000 migrants there, and he's been prevented from doing so because they've deemed that the tents they were going to live in was unsanitary and there were infrastructure problems. In fact, today, there are 22 Cuban migrants who are living in that are from the United States, living here and were picked up probably by masked men. The Cubans had a brown face, so they were picked up and they were flown directly to Cuba. This was done just on or about, in or about December 10, just a few days after a federal court judge here in the United States ruled that the Trump administration exceeded its authority in holding migrants that were designated from deportation from the United States to the Navy base at Guantanamo. So as your Stephen Rohde said in the earlier show, there's been a big failure of this administration to follow the law, and that's what's going on with that. Now, in addition to that, over the course of 2025, there's been 710 immigrants. Why are they there? Because if you've ever heard of a famous baseball player by the name of Yogi Berra, Yogi Berra said, "It's deja vu all over again. What am I talking about?" When Donald Rumsfeld was relevant, very relevant, in opening up Guantanamo in January 2002, he said, "We're going to hold the worst of the worst." And of course, we know that almost everyone ever in Guantanamo has been released without charges. Okay? In the beginning of 2025, Trump's border czar, Tom Holman, said, "We're going to hold the worst of the worst." Who did he mean? He meant we're going to hold migrants who have criminal arrests and serious criminal convictions. Today, in Guantanamo, and over this course of this last year, where there's been 710 immigrants, and I'm quite sure there'll be more to come, we have living in there people with no criminal arrests, no criminal convictions, that are housed there. We have children that are housed with single adults in unsanitary conditions. Because they're in Guantanamo, currently they have the inability to speak with a lawyer. There's no educational services for children. And we have 1,000 government employees, 1,000 that are assigned to staff the migrant operations at a cost of $100,000 per day per migrant. So if and when we have 400 migrants living in the base, it's going to be $40 million per month. And this is at a time that Donald Trump and Elon Musk and Doge are trying to cut our federal budget. So that's what's going on there at the moment. And we can expect more to come.
Wow. Well, as I said in the intro, people are not just standing idly by. There are a lot of groups and individuals who are rallying to demand that Guantanamo Bay closes. Can you talk about some of the allies of who are the organizations who are doing these calls? And then after you let us know kind of who the players are and what the obstacles may be to achieving that, let listeners know also what they can do, and especially about the rallies this weekend.
I certainly can. First of all, the rally this weekend right here in Los Angeles is going to be this Sunday, January 11. It's a closed Guantanamo protest rally. It's to release all the detainees that are still there, the 15, and those who are or will be in ICE prisons at the Navy base. The location is at the Wilshire Westwood Federal Building at 11,000 Wilshire Boulevard. It will take place between 12 o'clock and 1:30. We really, really want people to attend because the government needs to know that while, unfortunately, a lot of the Gitmo detainees have been forgotten for a number of reasons that I don't think I have the time to get into, the issue with the detainees, with the migrants, is so flagrant, so bad, and has taken place here all across the country. And people are seeing their neighbors who have lived here peacefully for 20 years being taken away, some by masked men, and without any delays, they're being flown to Guantanamo with no access, no communication. It's a terrible thing. These are all human rights violations. We really want you to show up and be seen. It'll make a difference. It'll be a legal and peaceful protest, just like the previous ones that I have been engaged in. And the host has held almost every year now since at least 10 years ago. The speakers include representatives from the National Lawyers Guild. I believe that yours truly, Jim Lafferty, will be there, if health-wise, we hope. Code Pink, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, the one that's been really behind all of this every year is the Interfaith Communities United for Peace and Justice, and me, as a former Gitmo lawyer. Many organizations around the country have been crying for the closing Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, and many, many others.
And can you give listeners a sense of, you know, if they want to know more, if they want to know more about the history of it or what's happening now, what are some of the trusted resources where you go for information?
I go, first of all, I Google. I do Google, and now we get the ChatGPT more in-depth videos. So I've actually picked some stuff up there. There's so much history that they can Google and get facts, not just from journalists, but court cases, and learn the history of what has happened, some of which I've discussed today, and now what's going on in Guantanamo. So somebody wants to know, are people being deported to Guantanamo? They'll get an answer, and they'll tell you exactly how many people are there today, how many people have been there over the year, etc.
And I know once we had you on previously, we were talking about a movie, I Am Gitmo, which was, I was looking for the, where people can, they can Google it. And thanks for admitting that you Google. I Google too. So before we go, we are out of time. Michael Rapkin, do you have any last thoughts to leave listeners with? And especially, you know, you mentioned just showing up and showing the government what you think, you know, just showing up. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I can say that in years past, these protest rallies held on January 11 are really sparsely attended. And I think it's because Guantanamo detainees have been mostly forgotten, mostly because they have secretive hearings. It's in Cuba. The journalists are not allowed to communicate with the prisoners. There's just a lack of discussion by the in the press about what is going on. But now, with what's going on across the country, people are, I believe, up in arms, and this is urgent. And if people want to walk the walk and simply not just talk the talk and say to their spouse or significant other, what a damn shame this is, they need to show up just like we've done in the No Kings rally. It is and will make a difference.
Well, thank you so much. We are out of time. Thank you for being with us today, Michael Rapkin. And thanks also Ozzy Flamenco on the station board and Jim Lafferty, who's hopefully listening at home, and he'll be back next week. And thanks, everyone. Stand up for your rights.
Stand up for your rights. Bye-bye. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more.